Recorded live in blustery downtown Newtown, this is Rancho Notorious, a podcast about movies and other cool stuff. You can find this and all the other episodes of the show at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious. Welcome everybody to Season 2, Episode 16 of Rancho Notorious. I'm Dan Slevin, and here with me in Wellington, New Zealand is Kaylee Carruthers. G'day, Kaylee.
Hello.
It's a pleasure to have you here. And also with us here in the Rancho studio is special guest Andy James, one of the world's foremost experts on the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Andy, welcome to Rancho Notorious.
Kia rana, thanks for having me. Thanks for upping me big time.
No pressure.
I hope that we're not putting you under undue pressure here, but you're here because you have recently commenced and completed a project to rewatch all of the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies in time, in preparation for watching Avengers Age of Ultron. Am I correct?
Almost correct. I had to not watch Guardians of the Galaxy. It's not Avengers. Mm. Just to be nerdy about that. And I had to miss one Avengers film, and I decided to miss The Incredible Hulk because it's not super great.
So your project was Avengers focused,
Avengers movies,
not necessarily Marvel Cinematic Universe. Ah, so here we go. Because are they not all converging at a future point?
Possibly. We don't know yet. They've got a big secret plan. We don't know what it all is, though.
All right. Well, we'll be discussing that in more detail, and we'll be quizzing Andy about his impressions of Age of Ultron.
Cool.
And also how it fits in with the Avengers timeline, with their character arcs, and the general tone of the thing. This is going to be giving the Avengers a lot more attention than, frankly, you know, serious attention than it probably deserves. But, you know, that's what we're all about here at Rancho Notorious, giving things more attention than they deserve. Right. We will also be talking about rather more serious, because this is Anzac weekend. Mm. We are, in fact, recording on Anzac
Day,
Day Observance.
Observance, sorry.
Yeah, here in New Zealand. Thank you, Government of New Zealand, for Mondayizing the public holiday of Anzac Day. So Anzac Day was Saturday. We get a day off today. Oh, there we go. It's finally finished. We get a day off today, and we're going to take advantage of that by recording Rancho Notorious. So there'll be some various things about the show that are not what we would normally do, partly because facts have not yet arrived for us. But we'll probably still be posting on Thursday-ish, just because of work pressures and time pressures, etc., etc. So bear with us if we're not as fully up to date as you might want, dear listener.
Yes.
We will be as... Actually, frankly, facts have never been that important to us.
No.
So why change the habits of a lifetime, really? Yes, because it's Anzac weekend, the big Anzac movie release for this weekend is Testament of Youth, Vera Brittain, the adaptation of Vera Brittain's memoir, which is about the effects of World War One on... some people from England. The Water Diviner was the Australian sort of contender for Anzac movie, and that opened around Christmas time, but is only just opening in the US this week. So that's Russell Crowe's first film as director, so we might see a little bit later on whether that's made any impact on the US box office when we get to that. But before we do, let's check the mailbag, because it's been about a week and a half since we recorded our last show.
Yes, and another exciting news on this day. Today, officially today, about right now, is my 5-year anniversary of landing in Wellington.
5 years.
And the weather was exactly the same.
It hasn't changed.
It hasn't changed. Yeah. So 5 years, half a decade, not bad. Let's start with
you are now a crucial part of the Wellington cultural firmament, aren't you?
Am I?
You are. You're a pillar.
Am I?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Can I get a badge that says that? Just pillar.
No, just the Rancho Notorious one.
Yeah.
Just walk around with it and everyone will go, she's a pillar.
Yeah. Sounds so much better, the Kiwi accent. Drop the R off the end. Chris Horman, also known as the Merca on Twitter, said, "Cinephile happiness, watching the Cannes 2015 announcements roll in when listening to the latest Criterion Cast and Rancho podcast episodes."
Not simultaneously, I hope, because that would involve like one podcast in one ear, one in the other ear. Maybe, and the eyes focused on the website. I know he is a very, very intelligent person, but even that might be beyond the best of us.
Maybe he did. Barnaby HM tweeted, "Saw Furious 7, two words for Rancho podcast, fittingly ridiculous. And also fittingly, the final shot racked me with sobs. Phew." Aw, bless. Adzabel asked, "Anyone seen Age of Adeline?"
And nobody answered, but we will come to that because it has now been seen by some of us. So when we do the US countdown, we'll cover that.
Cool. Sam McCosh, one of our Australian correspondents, said, "Good episode, that last one."
Thanks, mate.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Sorry, I'm just going to be here in the background offering random comments.
Yeah, perfect. It's ideal.
And, of course, we have our contest running to win a copy of the fabulous book by Miriam Ruth Ross, who was on our show last
episode. Yeah, we've had a couple of entries, and we, you know, like all of our competitions, we're going to hold it open a little while longer because it does take a while for people to catch up with the shows. Not everybody's like, you know, listening or waiting for them to be down to be uploaded, you know, on the night.
Exactly. So Siobhan Leachman tweeted, "Just listened to season 2 episode 15. Best 3D movie for me is Avatar. First 3D movie I ever went to, and the scene with the floral plants, hashtag amazing." There you go. And Fred Thompson, of course, have to have him representing every week. "Check out Dread 3D 2012 for impressive hyper-realistic visuals. Rare to see 3D actually enhance the look and feel of a film," which I agree with. I remember seeing that film and being like, whoa, this is way more awesome than I thought it would be.
My favorite, maybe this is true of lots of people, but my favorite 3D movie is still the first 3D movie that I saw. And it was U2 3D. The concert movie the National Geographic put together. And why are you giggling? Like, Karen and I had this conversation the other day about why do people laugh when you mention U2? Because, like I'm still very fond of them. But, you know, and I feel like I have to defend this.
I think it's because you say things like, you're still fond of them. They're not really rock and roll stars anymore. They're kind of like your four uncles.
Well, who hack into your phone and leave their album on your doorstep.
That give
you
a free lot album. Of people off them.
Free album. okay, so it's partly because Adam Clayton, the bass player, is a second cousin of mine.
What? How long have we been podcasting together? It's the first time you've dropped that.
Yeah, well, he's the least cool of the four, you see, and that's why I hold that information back.
My dad's second cousin played keyboard for Bryan Adams on tour.
There you go. That's right.
That's like the Canadian YouTube.
Yeah, exactly. No, fair enough, too. Let's get it all out there. Andy, who's your...
Got nothing.
So you know, from my school days, I've always known that there was this connection, and like you know, War and then Unforgettable Fire and all. I actually did really love those albums, and I still enjoy listening to them to this day. And that 3D concert movie that was put together by National Geographic as a real test of 3D's potential, digital 3D's potential, and it was played for 1 week at Reddings here in Wellington, and just those 7 days, and it actually did blow my mind. Not necessarily because of the U2-ness of it, but I got a sense that clever directors, intelligent directors, and editors would be able to layer images. And this is something that they did in this movie, is that they actually didn't just cut from shot to shot and just make a 3D version of a standard concert movie. What they were able to do was actually have a portion of the screen. They were able to layer images dimensionally, if you know what I mean. So you had a different image that led the foreground, but you could still see in the background a completely different image. It was a brilliant new way of putting images together, so you could gather more information, visual information about the thing you were seeing. And I'd love to see it again to see whether I would still be as impressed, but it's disappeared. Nobody's, you know, it had that 1 week, not shown on television as far as I can work out. It's not become a 3D Blu-ray or anything like that, so you just can't see it anymore. The other thing that I remember really strongly about that U2 thing, a lot of it was shot in Rio, in one of the giant $200,000-$300,000 people stadiums, and there's a thrust stage out into the audience, and Bono walks out onto that and starts singing, and the camera follows behind him, and there's something about standing behind him as you can see off into the distance, just the sea of people. Just endless sea of people responding to what he's singing. And you think, yeah, if that was my day job, I'd probably have a big head too. Actually, I can totally understand why he's the way he is. And it's like, oh, fair enough, you know. Anyway, that's a digression, obviously.
I'll just jump in here because I've just now thought of what my favourite 3D film was, because I listened to the podcast and I was trying to think what my favourite 3D film was, because I'm generally not a fan of 3D. And mine is How to Train Your Dragon.
Yeah.
I think 3D works really well in flying scenes. Mm. It really gives you a sense of flying with the characters.
That's another strength of Avatar, isn't it? Is that kind of motion. And I remember watching the very first Sam Raimi Spider-Man film, which obviously wasn't in 3D because it wasn't happening at the time, and feeling really kind of nauseous at the fact that the camera would move in a slightly different direction to Spider-Man as he swung, and it really frustrated me as a viewer because I couldn't anchor myself in space mentally to know what was going on, and so I just felt motion sick. But once you start to see things in 3D, that sort of motion becomes more natural, I think. He said making shit up as he goes along. the mailbag is complete.
There's some more in there, but if you want to catch up with all the exciting conversations that happen, please come find us on Twitter. Haha, you're trapped now.
Indeed. Now, because of the day of the week that we are recording, it's a Monday, the weekend is not actually complete for New Zealand and Australia. It's a holiday weekend for both countries. And so we don't have a New Zealand box office for this weekend. There's no point telling you about last weekend because ancient history now. But
we have the terrifying North American box office.
We do, exactly. So Kaylee's going to give us... why don't you start at number 10 and then...
Yeah, let's do that. Okay. At number 10, down from 7, Woman in Gold. In at number 9, down from 8, Monkey Kingdom. Anyone?
No idea.
Anyone?
Oh no, it's a Disney. It's a Disney live action nature thing.
Oh, they're doing more of them.
Yeah, like that lion one that they did, and so anthropomorphizing animals.
Easier with monkeys, surely.
Oh, I'd imagine it's probably not a big stretch for them, but they're not talking.
No I feel like no anthropomorphized documentary could ever be better than Land of the Bears. That was just incredible. If you have a chance to ever see Land of the Bears, please
do. That sounds like a very North American perspective.
It was... No. It gave
Canadian bears? Brown bears?
No, actually, it was bears... European brown bears. Huh? And the reason it was... I need to compose myself. The reason it was so good is because the narrator basically gave them all these, like, deep and meaningful thoughts. Like, they would gaze back at the mother bear and think... They would never be a young bear again, and he had to move on with his life.
And that maybe going to college isn't such a smart move. Yeah.
It was like a National Geographic documentary meets like I Heart Huckabees. It was amazing. It was amazing. Like, oh gosh. Anyway, moving on. Number 8, down from 6, Get Hard.
Couldn't go down hard enough. That one. Yep.
In at number 7, down from 5, The Longest Ride.
The Longest Ride. Now that's Nicholas Sparks, right? That's the Nicholas Sparks rodeo romance movie. And isn't it brilliant that the Nicholas Sparks movies now don't even need to cast even vaguely recognizable stars anymore, because just those poster images, just
I think the last one where they had a vaguely recognizable character, they had Channing Tatum. I think he was in the last one that actually had a star in it.
Just give me a moment there.
Okay. Moving on. In at number 6, all the way up from 15, Ex Machina. Anyone?
Oh, yes. Ooh. This is the new film by Alex Garland, who wrote Sunshine and The Beach.
Yes.
And it's a science fiction movie, and it's apparently, it's open, relatively small in terms of numbers of screens in the States, but the fact that it's dropped into the top 10 so early, it bodes very well for a big expansion, I think.
Been hearing good things about it.
Mm. In at number 5, all the way down from 3, Unfriended, which is the horror movie about a girl who has an unsavory video posted about her online, and I think she kills herself and then comes back to haunt everyone and kill them.
Right.
So in case you wanted to see that when it comes
out.
Just
back to Nicholas Sparks for a moment, and working our way back from The Longest Ride, which 2015 featured Scott Eastwood. Is that an Eastwood son? Is he one of the Eastwoods? Maybe. Britt Robertson. So basically no star power there at all, except Alan Alda in the supporting role.
Just drop that in.
Well, I'm just working my way down IMDb. Just working my way down IMDb, because people have to work, right? So anyway, so the last one before that was The Best of Me, which is a poster of a man and a woman with their faces very close together.
really?
No, I've amazing.
Never seen that on a Nicholas Sparks. I know.
James Marsden.
Oh, sorry, James Marsden.
Yeah, James Marsden and Michelle Monaghan. So actually, not complete non-entities there. Safe Haven. I think that last one didn't actually get released here, but Safe Haven, again, man and a woman, their almost faces almost touching. Josh Duhamel. Yeah, so he's and Julianne Hough. Ugh. Do you remember her from
Footloose? She
and also Rock of Ages.
Yep.
Okay, so obviously, you know, these mid-level stars, they realize they just don't need them anymore. The lucky one, who's in that one? Zac Efron.
Yes, I had to see that one.
Zac Efron and Taylor Schilling.
Sorry, I just don't know what order these came out in, and so
No, because how far do I have to go back before we get to Channing Tatum?
Channing Tatum was Dear John.
Okay, so before we get to Dear John, the last song...
Miley Cyrus.
Liam Hemsworth.
Yes.
Pineda.
And then they dated.
And then Dear John, 2010. Oh. Channing Tatum. Before Channing Tatum quite became Channing Tatum. And isn't that the one with Richard Jenkins?
I didn't know that Miley Cyrus movie was a Nicholas Sparks.
Right.
I was just like, oh, it's a Miley Cyrus song.
So here we go. Channing Tatum, Amanda Seyfried, Richard Jenkins. I'm pretty sure Richard Jenkins gets Alzheimer's in this one. Is that...
I haven't seen it.
Okay, no, that was when
Look at the poster, how unique.
No, they're not facing each other.
The poster, look. There's, yeah, on a beach.
Yeah, so maybe, you know, they obviously realised that Lassie Hallström, good director, that, you know, you can't break the chain, can't break the pattern.
No.
There you go. So anyway, that's that.
Anyway, still sitting at number 4, Home, the animated movie.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, in at number 3 this week, Age of Adeline.
Right, now Age of Adeline, we did get asked a question about whether anybody had seen it. Anybody in the room seen it?
No.
Anybody in the room keen to see it?
No. Not really.
Does it have that guy from Game of Thrones, though?
Yeah.
I think he's also in Orphan Black.
There are so many actors in Game of Thrones that every film now has that guy from Game of Thrones.
I was going to say, wasn't it the Testament of Youth? That's got the guy from Game of Thrones in it.
Exactly.
Oh my God, they're everywhere.
They are everywhere. They give them a good, you know, 6 months off between seasons to go off and make something else.
It's become the new Harry Potter.
The Age of Adeline is a vehicle for Blake Lively. Is that, have I got that name right?
Yeah.
Right. Who has not been acting for a while because she is Ryan Reynolds' missus.
She also had a baby.
That's right. Exactly. So there's been whole family sort of stuff, but this is her sort of coming back.
She hasn't not been working because she's a wife. She's
for the baby. No, it's the
she's
family.
Not, like, she's not been working. She's been pregnant.
Because he said no.
I want my career to be bigger than yours.
Okay, welcome I knew what I meant.
Welcome to the 40s.
Yeah. So so The Age of Adeline, this is a story of a woman who was born in 1908, and at the age of 29, she has a car accident that drives her car into some freezing water at the same time as there's a thunderstorm and lightning strikes the car, and the combination of the freezing water and the lightning basically completely shuts down her metabolism, and she does not age.
She becomes immortal.
Effectively, yeah. And this is, strangely enough, a really big problem for her. And she kind of freaks out that she thinks that the US government are going to try and take her and do experiments on her. So she runs away and just keeps changing her identity in order to maintain a sort of semi-normal life. But of course, because everybody around her is getting older, she's decided that she can't possibly have a relationship with anybody because, you know, she will just have to watch them die and that would be awful, right? One of the people that she... she basically, if the guy from Game of Thrones, name escapes me, bearded guy, Thorin.
I'll look it up.
Doesn't help.
The guy who's sleeping with the lady who was, you know.
Doesn't really help. The dragon lady. And we are so full of facts, aren't we, in this show? This is the show you listen to for facts.
That guy from Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Oh, that.
Right. Anyway, so he's managed to maintain an American accent for pretty much the whole film. He's one of those dot-com millionaire type people who sold his business for $1 billion, and now he's what? Michelle something.
Yeah, Michael Michelle Huisman. I'm not sure how to pronounce the name. He's from the Netherlands.
Right.
He suddenly just became 100 times more attractive in my eyes.
Right, and long hair and beard. Anyway, dot-com millionaire falls for Adeline, who's a librarian in, you know, sort of hidden away in San Francisco, trying to live a quiet life. And it turns out that she... This is not a spoiler, because it pretty much happens about halfway through the film that we realise this, but he takes her home to meet his parents, and it turns out that she had a thrilling love affair with Harrison Ford, who is his dad, back when he was about the same age. And so stuff comes home to roost, shall we say.
Yeah, exactly.
And the best thing about this film is the fact that in the flashbacks there is some young guy. You've got the cast list there, Kaylee. You can find out who this is. I didn't recognize him, but the guy playing the young Harrison Ford has worked his ass off to get the Harrison Ford smirk. And seriously, we were just sitting there going, ooh, that's clever. That's not digital. That's like somebody... it was like watching Chris Pine do Shatner in the first of the rebooted Star Trek. It's like, ooh, that's like... You're like acting, but you're also...
Shatnering.
Yeah, I know. Really, very good. So, but it was a long time coming, that moment.
What was the character's name?
We'll just look up Harrison Ford. It's the same name as him.
Yeah. Right. Oh, sorry.
God, do I have to do everything?
Yes.
Anyway, so while Kaylee's
Time.
Yeah, while Kaylee's scrolling through IMDb,
Anthony Ingruber.
Never heard of him. And
a fantastic name.
Yeah,
Ingruber.
So there you go. So obviously got a huge amount of talent at the young Harrison Ford.
He was an Ford. Avatar.
Oh, that probably means he came to New Zealand, and maybe he's a Kiwi.
And he's fully fluent in Dutch and in conversational French.
Which one are you talking about now?
The same guy.
Oh, you're talking...
I'm just taking random facts from IMDb right now, being really unhelpful.
Yeah. Can you focus? Anyway, so The Age of Adeline, it feels like it should be one of those romances adapted from a novel. Not quite Nicholas Sparks, but like The Time Traveler's Wife or something like that. You know, you think, oh, this is being really reverent to its original source. And we were sitting there fully convinced that this was an adaptation of a novel, and then it wasn't. Somebody had actually written it from scratch for the screen. And yet, you'd think if they'd done that and they didn't have any responsibility to be committed to a particular source material or to fans or anything like that, they would have made something quicker, funnier, smarter.
But better.
Better, yeah. So, I mean, it's like most films these days, it's too long. And it's kind of repetitive, so there's a bit of the same argument happening in multiple scenes over and over again, and it seems to be absolutely besotted with Blake Lively in terms of her prettiness. It just seems to rely incredibly heavily on her being pretty and looking good in frocks, and the my partner Karen, who's a costumier, assures me that the clothing was very intelligently handled. Like, the design was really, really good. The fact that she in her modern day costume, she's wearing stuff that reflects all of the eras that she's lived through. And so it was done really, really well. So that sort of production design stuff done well. But in the end, you just go, not that great a story in the end. Not that great a story to sustain the kind of weight that it's given it. So there you go.
Do you have two words?
I would say, well, we actually got a request for this review, so I'm going to say Adzabil. No.
There you have it. Okay, moving on. Sad news. In at number two, sitting number two, Paul Blart's Mall Cop 2.
Because
there's a sequel?
There is. Yeah. Because the clamour for a sequel was unanswerable. Definite. In the end. It was. What can they possibly... How could they possibly answer that? Did that film get... It did get a release here because I reviewed it, the first one.
Yes, you did.
Yeah. And there were two, in the same way that we have occasionally had people have had the same idea more than once, and we've had, dueling Los Angeles earthquake and volcano movies, and we've had, various ideas to sort of land twice at the same time. There were two... Mall Cop films at once, wasn't there? There was a Seth Rogen one.
Different ones, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Seth Rogen one was very dark, wasn't it? And Paul Blart, Mall Cop, was not dark and not funny.
There you go.
Yeah.
Hence a sequel for Paul Blart, not Observe and Report.
But that, no, exactly. But that $15.5 million in week one.
Yep.
No, week two.
Week two.
That's still pretty...
And in the number one position, Furious 7, with a weekend gross of over $18 million.
Yeah, so important to know that Avengers Age of Ultron not opened in the US as yet, still just in overseas territory, so not having any impact. Although apparently even though Furious 7 is still number one, the entire top 20 is basically down quite a lot on previous weeks in the pre-Avengers lull.
And speaking of The Water Diviner, which did open, it opened in the top 20 at number 14. So.
And that's on a relatively low, small number of screens, I would imagine. So,
yeah, 320 screens, if that's correct.
In fact, actually, looking down the numbers of screens, that's actually the smallest number of screens for a release in the top 20?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So not a bad effort for Russell Crowe with his first film there, for a film that I would imagine American audiences would be completely oblivious to in lots of ways, Gallipoli, Australia, Anzacs, etc., etc. Probably, not going to have much of a register. So the fact that he's made the money that he has is a good effort. Now, what else were we going to talk about in terms of... Oh, that's what I was going to mention. Furious 7 has, in fact, cracked $1 billion internationally, globally rather, which makes it now in the top three box office films of all time.
I just want to know how many secrets they're going to give away in the behind the scenes on the DVD.
Not many, if any. But I noticed that at the recent CinemaCon, which is not the same as Comic-Con. CinemaCon is the convention for cinema owners, and that happened a week ago. And Vin Diesel turned up, and surprising nobody announced that there would be a Fast and Furious 8.
Oh.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Like, they've built this crew up the past three films, and now most of them are gone.
Well, I think we're going to learn a lesson, aren't we, from the Avengers about renewal of your team. So we'll come to that a little bit later on. But I think as long as Vin Diesel's there, and as long as they can get Dwayne Johnson back to do three or four days from a hospital bed or like a little
even
top
more.
And
more rock,
please. More rock.
This is the thing, is that they, as we know from actually a friend of mine tweeted this at the time of the last X-Men film, and it was a really astute little tweet, which is basically, it's like, it's really interesting to see how the director has managed to make those scenes work considering none of those people were in the room at the same time. You know, it's like you've got this huge ensemble, and they've all got their contractual obligations, and they've all got their other things that they have to do. And it's like, yep, you've got 5 days with me, but it's not the same 5 days as Wolverine. So you just work it out, schedule Jeez. It. Damn it! And that's what's going to happen with all of these films. The ensemble will grow, but you'll find that. Then you know there might only be one scene where they're all in the same room at the same time.
Yeah, but with Fast and Furious, you know, they've built this crew up, and so Paul Walker's the actor has died, and his character has gone off to his happy ever after. Two of the other characters have died, so
two of the other characters they didn't even bother reintroducing for 7; they just killed them off screen.
No, they died. Well, one of them died in 6, and the other died in 3.
Now, hold on, didn't Jason Statham kill one in Tokyo?
Drift, the third one.
No. Jason Statham killed one before, like remotely in 7.
Yeah,
the one they call Han Solo.
Yes, Tokyo Drift. They have a weird chronology.
Yes,
so
I read about that.
Fast and the Furious 5 and 6 happened before Fast and the Furious Tokyo Drift.
Stop it.
It's amazing. They brought Han back for Fast and the Furious 5 because he was such a fan favorite character.
Shut the front door.
I will not shut the front door. I'll leave it wide open.
Yeah. It was like a last-minute decision when they realized after showing Tokyo Drift to test audiences that people were like, oh, well, where's the Fast and Furious crew?
Do I need to read the Wikipedia page for Fast and Furious before I watch the next film?
I think you need to go back and rewatch all of the films, Dan. Put yourself through that.
I feel used somehow now because...
Yeah. But that's why it doesn't have a number. Fast and Furious Tokyo Drift.
Exactly.
Didn't have a number.
Wait, so then it's not Fast 5? Because the fourth one was just Fast and Furious. Maybe Fast 5 is 5 of them?
So We're missing one. We are missing one. Get ready.
Maybe the next film is not Fast and the Furious 8. It's Fast and the Furious 3.
That would
Get ready, Weta. We need more face work.
I'm going to have to stop for a moment and try and absorb this information. Meanwhile, we'll have a clip from Avengers: Age of Ultron, and then let's skip teams, ensembles, and universes, and go to the Avengers one.
I tried to create a suit of armor around the world, but I created something terrible:
artificial intelligence.
Called the Ultron program. People will look to the sky and see hope. I'll take that from them first.
The Avengers: Age of Ultron. I reviewed this on Radio New Zealand last Thursday, mainly because I wanted to hear Catherine Ryan say the word Ultron. More than once, and this is a film that the build-up has been absolutely enormous. It's Joss Whedon's last go-round with the Marvel crew, although I would be amazed if he's not on call to sort of buff up some script in the future. But, I mean, this is the last chance that we're going to get the original Avengers crew all together in one go. Andy, you were rewatching the all the films that contained the Avengers in advance of it. Maybe you could tell us, first of all, because first of all, Kaylee slept through a lot of
through us talking about it now.
Yeah, wakey wakey. Kaylee slept through quite a lot of the Avengers on Friday night, and so therefore probably can't do a plot summary. I was in the front section at the embassy for the screening on Wednesday, and it was really, really loud, so I couldn't hear a lot of the plot. So mate, you might be our only guide to actually what the heck was going on.
Oh, dear. very quickly, I'll say the robot Ultron is created by Tony Stark and then decides the best way to keep humanity safe and the planet safe is to kill everyone, as all evil robots do.
And and Ultron, he's not just a robot, is he? He's like a cross between a robot and the internet. In that, because he's got some kind of cross technological consciousness that means he can infect all sorts of devices and knows, and he can see what's going on in satellites.
The many Ultron copies,
right? And it's almost as if there's this effort by Tony Stark to create the ultimate safety net for the world, right?
An armor that can cover the entire Earth.
Yeah,
because that's his thing.
Yeah, and basically he gets to switch it on, and then almost immediately it goes bad.
Yep, don't make AI, people.
He didn't even know he was making AI at the time, did he? He just thought he was making something that had that was clever, but AI was a
some stuff going on with weapons found in the previous Avengers film as well. I got a little muddled.
Weapons, but there was also some kind of
Infinity Gem.
The Infinity Gem,
yep.
Which is another. It's not a MacGuffin because you can see it, but it's another. It's another Asgardian Norse god thing from there.
Oh, look, we're going to get super nerdy here. I'm just going to start getting right into it. Okay, yeah. So this is what all of these films have been leading up to since the end of. The first Avengers with the tag, Purple Man, Thanos turns around and gives his little smile and all the comic book nerds go crazy.
Mm.
So all of the films sort of since then have had, or typically all of the Marvel films have had some sort of Infinity Stone link. These are the Infinity Stones that control, what is it, mind, time, the soul, reality, and power. And you put them all together and you have complete control over reality. And that's Thanos'.
How many are there?
So there's like five or six.
Right.
I forgot to count.
They'll find another one if they need one. If they need one for the story, they'll embed one.
Oh, well, no, they won't, because it's all from the comic books.
It's canon, right?
But they have, changed them around a bit. I think the naming for some of them is different in the movies than it is in the comics. The whole storyline in the comics, at least, is that Thanos gets all of the Infinity Gems, and because he's in love with the personification of death, because he's crazy, kills half of the inhabitants of the universe, and then all of the heroes have to team up to stop him.
After he's done that.
Yep.
And Thanos is the purple guy.
He's the purple guy.
Okay. Right.
He's the Guardians of the Galaxy, and
he's the purple guy that if you stick around to after the main credits, but before the long scroll through everybody who ever animated anything, he turns up again, right? Yeah. So
spoilers, but not really.
Not really. It's like everyone knows that these things are going to happen.
It's all leading up to Infinity War Part 1 and 2.
Right. Now, my brain is sort of full at this point. I'm going to ask you, in terms of the Avengers characters, remind me, which is the first film that you would consider to be part of this extended arc? Which was the one? Was it the first Thor, or was it the first Captain America, or
Iron Man? I watched them in order of release.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's kind of the best way to do it. You could start with Captain America if you wanted to watch them chronologically. I don't think it matters. Just watch them Iron Man 1, 2, and 3 if you want. And then Avengers.
So Iron Man 1 was in terms of the Marvel Cinematic Universe or the Avengers Cinematic Universe, was Iron Man 1 sowing seeds already for this?
It was definitely sowing seeds for Avengers, because Nick Fury turns up at the end, everyone lost their mind. It was a very, it was the first post-credits tag. It was kept incredibly secret from all, like, press screenings and everything like that. It wasn't until it was actually in cinemas that you got to see Nick Fury turn up and talk about the Avengers. And then Marvel's grand plan of Captain America and Thor then spinning into a big team-up film was kind of revealed. It's insane.
It is. Something that interests me is that Karen and I watched Age of Ultron on Wednesday night. Sebastian hasn't seen that yet, but we decided that as a family we should probably rewatch, or for Sebastian in terms of... No, actually, I was the only one that had actually seen it before. Anyway, we thought Winter Soldier was... we'd seen the first Captain America. Everyone had seen the first Captain America, but only I had seen Winter Soldier. And so we watched that on Saturday night, and we watched the first sort of 20 minutes of Thor the Dark World, and we'll finish that before it has to go back to the video shop. But what really interested me going backwards to Winter Soldier after Age of Ultron was how different the tone was between those films, and how hard it was to, like, if you were trying to watch them as a, like, if let's say it's 20 years into the future and you're Netflixing your way through this Marvel thing and you want to binge watch them, like you might binge watch Game of Thrones or something, would it work?
I think if you were binge watching all of the Marvel movies 20 years into the future, it would work, because by the time you got to Winter Soldier or Age of Ultron, you would have lost your mind. They did have a giant Marvel marathon screening at the El Capitan Theatre in Hollywood, and I read the blog of someone who went, watched all of those films back to back to back to back to back to back, including Guardians of the Galaxy and then Age of Ultron. And it just sounded horrendous. 28 hours locked in a cinema.
Because these films, because they are so different. Even the two Captain America films are so different from each other in terms of tone and approach.
Yeah, but I think that's a good thing. Oh, you don't want them to all be the
no, it's
the
not
same
a
thing, do you?
Well, that, as I said to Catherine on 9 to Noon on Thursday, Age of Ultron felt to me like another episode in a soap opera that is going to take the rest of my life to complete. And because unlike a normal like a TV show where you only have to wait a week or not for the next episode, these are 18 months, 2 years apart before these, you know, and you can't remember what has happened. And
yeah, I think I've been thinking about this lately as well. They're going to get, I wonder how much trouble they're going to get into by the time Infinity War Part 2, which is the kind of grand culmination, rolls around, and how much people have to know of the previous films to watch it. And I think Age of Ultron suffers a little...
Previously on Age of Ultron.
Well, it's because the first Avengers was the grand experiment. No one knew if it was actually going to work. I think most people were sort of watching Avengers going, this isn't going to work, how can they make this work? Oh, this is working. Wow, this is working really well, this is great. With Age of Ultron, the formula's already been proved.
Hmm. But it's also being tested. So I would come back and say the reason why the first Avengers film works is because they have employed the greatest creator. Well, the greatest creator of ensemble, interrelationship, dialogue, character. You know, like Whedon is absolutely fantastic at nursing a bunch of different characters through a narrative and giving them all their moments.
And making it funny. And making it interesting for lots of different audiences. Mm.
I'll counter that with James Gunn and Guardians of the Galaxy. He did the exact same thing without the lead-up films.
Mm.
So Joss Whedon, as great as Joss Whedon is, and I do love Joss Whedon and what he does, he's not the be-all and end-all. And I have complete faith in the Russo brothers who directed The Winter Soldier to really pull it all together, because that's my flat out, I'm going to call it right now, flat out favorite Marvel movie.
We watched it again this weekend. Winter Soldier works spectacularly well as drama. It's dark. I really appreciate that. And this theme, I think, runs through all of these Avengers films. This idea that, you can agree with it or not. But basically, what it's saying is that government overreach is just going to be the
bad.
Yeah, it's bad. Basically, government is bad. Individual freedom is good, and it's why you want. A former Soviet assassin to be basically doing your duty for you. You know, it's like you want talented individuals to be doing their talented individualness rather than a bureaucracy creating a giant sort of overreaching scheme.
Well, that's kind of the whole thing with superheroes as well, because they're the lone protector. They do what the police can't. So it's that kind of thing writ large. And it's going to be, I think, even more so in the next Captain America movie when it's Captain America versus Iron Man, spinning out from a series in the comic books where Iron Man took a very pro-government approach, and it was all about heroes registering their secret identities and the bad guys possibly getting a hold of that and civil liberties and all this sort of jazz. No idea how it's going to go in the movies, though.
And Kaylee, from what you managed to stay awake for on Friday, first of all, you don't have to go into details about what you were doing leading up to the movie, why you fell asleep, but do you think there's any cinematic reason why you weren't there for it?
I think it started and it took me a while to figure out who all the people were on screen, because it had been a while since I watched The Avengers, and I was like, okay, what's going on? Am I supposed to know what's going on right now? And then I was worried. I was like, am I not smart enough to be here? What's going on? And it was just the movie. And it was great. There were some really great moments. Like, I really liked how it was, they brought in that AI and that, international sort of, internet, the whole security thing. I thought that was really interesting. I love Paul Bettany. So for him to, magically show up, that was great. Yes. And also James Spader as the voice of the bad guy.
Fantastic.
Mm,
see, not, James, just, not just the voice. Whole no. performance. I think
yeah.
his performance
James
capture.
Spader has been a baddie since the 80s. And I've always disliked him because he's always the bad guy. But he's such a good bad guy that I just dislike him. So I did find it interesting, the bits that I could stay awake for. But it was just relentless. It was just, it never stopped and it never gave me a break. And I was just like, oh, my eyes are
crammed. It was crammed, wasn't
it? There was a lot going on in that film. My goodness.
And I think a lot of the reason why there was so much going on, or it felt like there was so much going on, is that Whedon made a pact to himself that it would be shorter.
Shorter than The Avengers.
Than The Avengers.
Madman.
And obviously he decided that, that was a criticism that he was taking on board. And so, I read an interview with him, and he was talking about all the things he'd cut out of Age of Ultron to try and get it down under the, it was just this insane commitment that he's made, and as a result, there's no shifts of tone really.
Just needed a little bit of breathing room.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, except for when they go to the farmhouse Hawkeye's farmhouse, but that's like the one lull, and either there's shooting, punching, explosions, or wisecracks all the time.
And what made the Avengers, the first Avengers, so good was that that quiet time, when they're in the lab or doing stuff, and they're just talking to each other, and they have those hilarious conversations, and there's, the Hulk, Iron Man, relationship.
Science bros.
The science bros thing going on, and that's what made it so great and so funny. And this was just like, Where are the puns? I'm not having enough puns. There's too much punching. I can't do it.
Hemsworth,
too much punching, no puns.
Yeah,
I know, more puns.
Hemsworth as Thor, still very funny, I think, and he had some great moments.
Just kind of,
so great.
Just kind of like Groot. It's like Thor.
But I couldn't understand a word that Downey Jr. said through it, I really believe that it was just the where I was in the cinema and the how loud it was.
I think that the only times I couldn't hear the dialogue was because the audience was laughing too loud. I couldn't hear what was then going on screen. But
so I'm going to reserve final judgment on Age of Ultron because I figure that actually, and this is a terrible thing to admit, you know, as a cinema lover and a lover of watching things in big crowds, I just got a feeling that I'm going to enjoy it much more when it's here at home and I can hear it all and I can, you know, like Winter Soldier. I enjoyed Winter Soldier so much more on Saturday night with the family than I did at the time that I saw it at the cinemas. I got it a lot more. I appreciated the density of the drama of it. And this is why I'm looking forward to Infinity War, is because even though Whedon's not going to be involved, they've given it to the Russo brothers, and I trust those guys, even though they'd never directed a film before.
Oh, I think they had, but...
Television sitcoms, isn't that where they came from?
You, Me and Dupree, I think, is a Russo Brothers film.
That's a classic.
Yeah. So the fact that they pulled off Winter Soldier is even more of a surprise.
You know, the action in Winter Soldier works, the drama of Winter Soldier works, the character development of Winter Soldier works, and as somebody said, when I announced on Saturday that I was watching it, I think it might have been Chris Orman who said, two-word review for Winter Soldier, Jenny Agutter.
You know? Absolutely.
Just... Yeah, it does. And so I just go, boom, you guys have got it. Guardians of the Galaxy is one that you said that you didn't rewatch, even though are connections.
There are connections, but we're talking about the Avengers. This was an Avengers film, so they're not part of the Avengers, they're their own team. And I just wanted to go back to something that Kaylee said, and that's the things you loved most about the first Avengers was them just hanging out. And I think that's why these films are so successful. People want to hang out with these characters. Yeah. They love... I could actually do away with all of the explodey stuff in Age of Ultron and just hang out with the Avengers at their party.
Because who really cares about...
It's just so much fun.
Because who really cares about the Republic of Skrovakia anyway?
Because the little contest and they're trying to lift Thor's hammer. That was great. That was a great moment.
Fantastic moment.
But see, here's my problem, and here's, I think, Marvel's problem, is that... They could make two films a year if they got rid of all of the big explodey action effects stuff and just wanted to make a relationship, like a film about the relationships between these people.
They do make two films a year. They're going to be making three next year.
Yeah, but we're not going to see... Well, what I mean is that...
You mean
it's
like
been
Avengers
2 years,
films?
Yeah. Don't you reckon?
I don't think you want two Avengers films a year, though. I think you want the Avengers films to be more of an event.
Well, do we? I don't know.
I mean, you still get...
I can't remember what happened in the last one.
With Winter Soldier, you still got Cap hanging out with Black Widow, and he had his new buddy the Falcon there as well. Mm. So they're all still hanging out together, and I think that's the thing. I think that's... If we can move into Marvel DC now.
Question about Winter Soldier.
Yes.
Just before we move on. I thought at the end of Winter Soldier, Captain America buggers off to go and find his mate, right?
Yes.
No mention of that in Age of Ultron.
The Falcon mentions it at the
party. And says, what are you doing here?
I've been chasing down cold leads. So there are no leads. I mean, you have to have Captain America in an Avengers film.
Until you don't.
Until the next one.
Until Avengers Rise of the Sidekicks, which is what the next one's going to be, right? It's like, I mean, wasn't that a whole changing of the guard at the end?
A little bit. I'm interested to see what happens over the next few films. There's going to be even more Iron Man, Captain America adversarialness going on in Civil War.
Why would there be adversarialness? They're lovely
people. Best buddies. Well, and because then you've also got actor contracts coming up, that kind of niggly stuff. I think Chris Evans only has a couple more.
Mm.
So he's only around
There was a whole thing of Downey Jr. not signing for Iron Man 3 until everybody got the same money he got, or everybody got more money. Like, there was something, I'm sure there was he didn't sign for Ultron until everybody got a rise. Because the thing about it, these are all Disney films, right?
No, they are, yeah.
Yeah. They're all effectively Disney films. And Disney are notoriously tight
Marvel even more so, actually.
Marvel. Exactly, Marvel even more so. One of my favourite stories is the late, great Robin Williams talking about working for Disney, and he called them Mauschwitz. And, and you know, but it took Downey Jr., took Downey to basically put his foot down and say, you know what, everyone's getting more dough on this one. And yes, so there are all these contractual sort of things coming up. And of course, one of the funny things about Age of Ultron is this is Thor trying to explain why Natalie Portman's not around.
Yeah, just that kind of busy work to explain why.
I sucked to that part.
Yeah. Why it's various characters aren't around, and it's just, oh.
Look, we do need to march on, because this has been the longest show in the history of Rancho Notorious, and we haven't even done the news yet, because it's so interesting. But
blab on about comic book movies for another few hours.
Well, you had it just before we leave you, and then we go to the news. You had a DC reference that you wanted to make.
Yeah, we've only had one film in this new DC.
Oh, the DC universe.
Yeah,
oh,
because
God.
This is. Because the Avengers were successful, now everyone's doing a shared universe. So DC are now doing that. So I just don't think they seem to enjoy their characters as much. And you've got the first post-Man of Steel.
But they're also serious.
Yeah. The first post-Man of Steel sort of in the DC universe is Batman versus Superman. It's not Batman hanging out with Superman, fight crime together. It's... Batman asking Superman if he bleeds.
I do. I did have, as a kid, a Batman versus Superman DC comic, and of course one of the key relationships in the Batman reboot, The Dark Knight from the 80s, involved an aging Batman trying to feeling incredibly envious of the role that Superman played in the life of the world, you know, and how everybody loved Superman. But
that was also a crazy old Batman.
It was, it was fascist Batman, basically.
Pretty much,
yeah.
It's Frank Miller, so he's a crazy man.
That's right. But, interesting. And so there's always been a kind of rivalry going on there.
There's always been a rivalry, but...
It just seems that, like, this idea that somehow the world would turn against Superman...
I just don't like it.
No, it doesn't really work.
Not my Superman.
No.
I think Marvel are doing a better Superman and Captain America than DC are.
But as a kid, because I was a Spider-Man fan when I was a kid, and so you sort of, it's like the Beatles and the Stones or whatever, you find yourself falling on one side or the other of that particular divide, and it was, or Marvel always felt to me like it was a world that I could understand and appreciate, and, you know, like there were characters, whereas DC always seemed to be about archetypes rather than
DC was
people.
Always they're the gods, yeah. Marvel was the heroes with the clay feet, and they actually lived in the real world. They lived in New York. That's a real city. And this
by the real world, they all live in New York.
talking
it's like
of New York,
superhero Mecca.
We've been embedded in this house. We have for the last week or so been embedded in the Marvel universe, because we have recently acquired the Lego Marvel Super Heroes Xbox game.
What a great game.
Oh,
it's so much fun.
It's thrilling.
There'll be no work done in this house for the foreseeable future. And of course it's all set in Manhattan, and it is, I tell you who somebody should make a documentary about, and that is the people who make these Lego games, because first of all they've managed to do deals with Marvel, with DC. You know, they haven't had to choose sides, they haven't had to play one off against the other. Everybody wants to work with them. We had an enormous... I've never actually played the game. I just watched Karen play it, and it's as much fun as watching the movies. The Lord of the Rings was fantastic fun.
Lego Harry Potter,
exactly. So there's something that they're doing corporately that makes everyone just go, yeah, we... And of course Lego Batman has already been greenlit as a film.
It's a film.
And that's going to be next year.
It's all gone a little bit crazy.
Hasn't it?
So I've rewatched all of the Marvel Avengers films, except for Incredible Hulk. And then I also watched...
Which Hulk one is that? Is
Edward
that...
Norton.
Oh, yeah, right.
I had to toss up between Incredible Hulk or Iron Man 2, and I couldn't go past Iron Man 2 because it has Sam Rockwell.
Yep.
So I've done all of that, and then I also, before Age of Ultron, I watched all of Agent Carter, the great Hayley Atwell.
Oh,
and
right. Oh, so you're... because all of this is part of the Avengers universe too?
It's all part of the same, TVs. Yeah, Marvel sort of universe. And then I also watched the Netflix Daredevil show. So I've kind of had a, as much as I love it all, I've had a bit of overload.
Do you live somewhere where there isn't very much to do?
Definitely. Nothing to do.
Because that sounds like you have a lot of time on your hands.
Well, I live in Rarotonga, so there's not a lot to do there.
Is there good internet there?
There's no internet there, Dan. None whatsoever. So I came home, and I've just been abusing the internet to watch Marvel TV shows.
Oh, man.
I still need to catch up on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., though, so that's next on my to-do list.
Which is, there was a very funny remark in the Whedon interview where basically he felt, because he handed Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. over to his brother to make, and the deal seemed to be that Agent Coulson had to either come back to life or not be dead or something.
One of the two.
Yeah, it was. That's a whole other thing.
And but I tell you what, whoever does the Agent Coulson voice in the Lego Marvel,
it's probably Clark Gregg.
It might be. Well, then I mean, they're not all the same voices, but yeah, it absolutely sounds like him. He is nailed on.
And we all needed more Clark Gregg in our lives.
Totally.
Well, yeah. I think it must be because he's the voice of Agent Coulson and the animated Marvel TV shows like Spider-Man and such, so...
Why not?
He's owned the character.
We could talk about this for hours and hours and hours, okay. and no doubt in the unrecorded After Dark when the...
Rancho Notorious After Dark.
in the rapidly overcooking roast pork that we're about to have.
Oh!
Shut up.
Time for some news.
Right.
Oh, turn it up. There we go. I'm not going to cut that out. This is how it works, guys.
We will blaze through. We will blaze through the joke-filled news headlines. Just so like listen carefully. We won't laugh. We're just going to get through it.
No.
Child 44, a new film starring Tom Hardy, about a Russian serial killer, has been banned in Russia, with Culture Minister Vladimir Medinsky saying it made Russia look like Mordor, and Russian citizens like physical and moral subhumans, a bloody mass of orcs and ghouls. Mr. Medinsky fails to realize that New Zealand has built an entire tourist industry on that very concept.
Missing the point.
The new Star Wars The Force Awakens trailer was released just over a week ago. How do we all feel about it? Are we still in possession of our shit, or did we all lose it?
Andy, Force Awakens, how did you feel? Did you have a gap in your Daredevil?
Have you awakened?
Yeah.
Did you have an awakening?
I was actually a bit angered because it's made me interested in Star Wars again after I swore off it. I think there are a lot of people who are now, damn it, you have my interest.
Yeah.
And in fact, my interest was reawakened when Rian Johnson was announced as the director for the next Star Wars film.
Well, and they've announced what the title of that is. Is that Rogue One?
No, that's the spin-off.
Oh my god. What?
Oh my god.
Yeah. So okay, so
how many Star Wars films?
This is why Disney's going to rule the world. So not only do Disney have their animated films coming out, they also have their two or three Marvel movies a year coming out, and then every year they're gonna have a Star Wars film. So there's gonna be Star Wars The Force Awakens, and then next Christmas will probably be Rogue One, which is a spin-off film.
And Christmas after that will be the
getting the Death Star plans, and then the Christmas after that will be Star Wars the next one.
And Riz Ahmed is gonna be in which one?
Rogue One, Rogue is rumoured to be.
Okay, yeah.
Also, Ben Mendelsohn,
rumoured
for that.
Great casting.
That's Gareth Edwards.
Yes, and a great
director. Rogue One. And they also have, his name has totally escaped me, but the guy who's doing the new Fantastic Four film, Josh Trank, is directing the second spin-off film. So there's going to be Star Wars every year, guys.
Wow.
This is the new reality.
Good for John Williams. it is extraordinary, and the for those I mean how many new films do you think they have to make before the three prequels will just sort of disappear into you know, people won't feel like...
They will never disappear.
No, but the people won't need to watch them. Because, you know, I remember watching the animated Clone Wars movie at the movies, and, that you know, that's supposedly canon as well.
I think everything that was released as a film is still canon. There's a whole bunch of Star Wars novels and comic books that are now no longer canon. The prequels will always be canon. George Lucas probably has that in the contract.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, moving on. Ryan Gosling is in talks for the impending Blade Runner sequel to be directed by Denis Villeneuve, which means I will love it and Dan will probably hate it.
Yeah, I think we can pretty much review that right now.
Yep. No.
Except that we both love Ryan Gosling. So, you know, he might be the saving grace.
Do you need a sequel to Blade Runner, though?
Yeah, but can Ryan Gosling save a Denis Villeneuve film for
you? Well, no, this is true. You're dead right.
And can Ryan Gosling save a Blade Runner film?
Yeah, well, exactly.
As long as there's a unicorn in it, I don't care.
Look, I'm going to reserve.
There is a unicorn in Blade Runner, isn't there?
There is.
There is.
Yeah.
You didn't, there is.
You didn't. I had an argument about
you
that.
You didn't
with
dream
someone.
The dream unicorn.
I got into an argument with someone about that once. Like, there's no unicorn. I was like, there is a unicorn. It is a critical moment.
It might depend on which cut.
Mm.
Yeah, and also maybe they blinked at that moment. You know, it would be like all it takes is for, you know, for a moment like that is for a reviewer to look down at their notes at the wrong time and then look up and then completely miss the point of the film.
Yeah, because they missed the unicorn.
Or to try and scoop some more ice cream out of their tub. You know, which is why I say if you're watching a film that's got subtitles, always choose the ice cream that's in a cone, not in the tub. Because you look down, you miss stuff, and it's just...
I feel like we need a sting for every episode where you have, like, some great advice.
Dan's tips. If you're watching a film with subtitles, use a cone, not a tub, for your ice cream. I've been to that.
I'm all about the people.
Oh, God. Speaking of people, Lars von Trier is drinking again, and therefore, he says, ready to go back to work.
Yeah, I think that should have been first.
Yeah. And finally, because it wouldn't be Rancho Notorious news without an update from the world of 50 Shades of Grey, Universal has announced that E.L. James's husband, TV scribe Niall Leonard, will write the next two episodes in the series, 50 Shades Darker and whatever the third one is called.
I was expecting you to fill in that gap.
Why?
Do you not know what the third one is called?
Don't say 50 Shades of Grey followed by filling in a gap. Don't put that in the same sentence, Dan.
No.
All right. Time is marching on. Kaylee, we should talk about a very serious, worthy film.
We should. Testament of Youth.
Yeah.
Be strong. Be brave. But above all else, be loyal to your homeland.
You signed up.
How many generations get the chance to be involved in something like this? I can't let others do my duty for me.
Our generation will never be new again. Our youth has been stolen from us.
All right, okay. It's very, very, very...
very serious.
Serious, somber weekend.
It is.
In Australia and New Zealand, because it's Anzac weekend. Here in Wellington, we've had a multi-million dollar park open as an extension to the War Memorial. And, of course, it's the centenary of New Zealanders and Australians landing at Gallipoli. And, of course, that is not in any way, shape or form a source of humour. Or, you know, we're totally respectful of that entire exercise. Cinematically, the Anzac film was, as we said earlier on in the show, was it would appear to be Russell Crowe's The Water Diviner, which came out at Christmas, so we don't need to talk about that. And there was a lot of stuff going on television and radio. I haven't actually seen any of it. Apparently Sam Neill made a documentary for Māori TV, which I've been reading exceptional responses to. So... you know, I look forward to maybe catching that on demand later on. But in terms of the cinema, the film that has been released to commemorate or to coincide or to cash in on the whole Anzac thing is Testament of Youth, a British film, BBC film, based on Vera Brittain's beloved memoir. So, Kaylee, you saw that today, as I did.
I did.
Although separately.
Yes. It was a beautiful film. It reminded me quite a bit of the recent Jane Eyre film. It's like cinematographically.
No, keep going.
A lot of close-ups, that sort of soft, beautiful, like...
Oh, it was very soft, wasn't it?
Very BBC soft, like, sort of period drama. But I found it quite moving. It was very beautiful. It was about, based on the memoirs, as we said earlier, Vera Brittain, who, she wants to go to Oxford. She has to fight against her father to go. Luckily she has a brother who's like, you know, let her go. I wouldn't feel good going back to Oxford without her. She, you know, she's determined to become a writer. She doesn't want a husband and she wants to pave her own path, which was quite brave at that time. But of course ends up falling in love with Kit Harington, obviously. Who wouldn't? His little side part happening. And meanwhile,
archdukes are being assassinated.
Yes. Yes. Archduke.
On the other side of the world.
Yes, and just as their romance is blossoming, he gets called away to war along with her brother, and she decides to abandon her studies at Oxford, which she has fought so hard to get into, to go become a war nurse and go to the lines and help them. And
she feels a responsibility, doesn't she? Because she persuaded her father to let her brother go. There was, you know, before anybody knew what this was going to be like, she basically said he wants to go. If he doesn't go, everyone's going to think he's a coward, effectively. Mm. And so please let him go, Dad. And then she starts to realize what she's contributed to, and wants to salve her conscience, but also make her own contribution to the war effort. So she becomes a nurse.
Exactly. And, of course, as it would during wartime, quite a lot of tragedy follows.
Yeah.
Like, I was crying a lot.
It's incredibly... you know, for a BBC production, which, you know, they have resource, but they don't have Avengers resource, you know, it did look quite spectacular in terms of the production design and the detail of and the history of it. This is a film that, you know, there's never going to be a huge amount of levity in it. Mm. It's not a... it's not a subject that lends itself to that, and the weight that the characters bear grows scene by scene by scene until it's almost unbearable. I don't know. I haven't read the original memoir, which is apparently still in print and which is still recognised as one of the great World War I. Pieces of literature, so I don't know how well it reflects that, but it seemed to be respectful almost to a fault.
Mm.
You know, like it's just very hard to bring life to something where you're trying to be so respectful to everybody's experience, not just hers, but everybody, you know, the millions who participated in the hundreds of thousands.
And that's one of the things that I liked about it, is they didn't pour sugar over it. They didn't make it puffy or like overly romantic. It was quite dark and it was quite sort of frank in its depictions. It wasn't overly violent, but there's a lot of her working as a nurse. There's a lot of blood. There's a lot of dirt. You know, it's quite, you know, visual. But I really like the way that they put it together. I like the cinematography. I like the way they told the story. It was beautiful. It was really, really beautifully done. And I'd watch it again. I highly recommend it.
We've talked about Kit Harington. Well, we haven't. We've just laughed at his expense.
But he's such a babe. Ugh,
and
can't handle it.
And you know, the Game of Thrones thing is that, you know, that it's going to be very difficult for all of those people from Game of Thrones to ever sort of get beyond those characters.
Except for Sean Bean, who's just, like, professional at dying. So.
Yeah, he just, well, he didn't even last a season. And Dinklage, of course, who is just amazing.
Yeah.
So there are a few people, and Charles Dance, who just is gruff, Mr. Gruff, everywhere he goes, you know, like, he's just Mr. Stern. Does he ever smile? Has Charles Dance ever smiled?
I don't think you'd want him to.
No. It's probably in his contract.
Maybe his face would start to crumble away.
Yeah. But all the new people, I mean, it's going to be very hard for them to overcome all of that stuff. I'm going to ask you about Alicia Vikander, who plays Vera Brittain, is the lead. I mean, she's in every shot, it seems to me, of Testament of Youth. And how do you feel like she coped?
I thought she was fantastic. I couldn't get over how tiny she was, how petite she was. I thought it was a bit disturbing. But
she's Swedish, right? So she's so I had occasional moments where the accent, she just didn't, particularly as the whole family is supposed to be from Yorkshire, and you've got Dominic West as her dad, and who's got a strong accent, and so I was just like waiting for an accent that wasn't just as flat, you know, she was, yeah. But anyway, you know, she looked astounding. She was always incredibly, immaculately well dressed, like some beautiful costumes for her. It was only in that final sort of act where it really got emotional for me. And there's a montage at the end where we see all of the places that she'd been, all of where she'd been surrounded by the people that she'd lost, and they're just empty spaces. That was a fantastic sort of representation of that loss for her. I want to love it. I want to be, you know, I'm really respectful of it, but I just, like, I've never warmed to it to be able to go, you know what, I want to be able to, for me, a movie that you love is a movie that you want to buy and own and have in your home and give to other people and all those sorts of things. And it never did that for me. And this yet is going, I wanted it to.
This is going squarely on my weepy shelf right beside The Constant Gardener. Like, if I just need to, like, let it out and cry, it's going to be Testament of Youth or Constant Gardener. Those two. I haven't had anything else that, like, brought me to tears.
Right.
Like those two.
Okay, well, two words for... do you have it?
Powerful story.
Right. Mine are, extremely sincere. Yeah, and it's a great story, well told. It's just not one that really wrapped
itself. Maybe it could have been slightly better if it was someone other than Kit Harington. I mean, like, Kit Harington's great, but
was there a distraction?
Wasn't a distraction. I just think his acting wasn't as strong in scenes where it should have been really, like, on point. He just sort of seemed like,
Well, now you're calling it.
80%.
And see, I've never seen him in anything else but Game of Thrones, so I don't know whether he's any good or not. Like, I mean, it's only when you see actors do a second or third job that you know whether they've got it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, that's the weird. It's like one of my favorite British.
You want to see him with Will Ferrell in a comedy about going to prison, and then you'll know how good he is.
No, I don't.
No, it's like one of my favorite TV shows was Skins, the British show, and so many of those actors have just moved to Game of Thrones. The only one who really got out was Nicholas Holt. Yeah, who's been doing some great work.
Who's going to be in Mad Max? Is that right?
He is in Mad Max.
Yeah, mental.
Yes,
but then he was also a little bit more established.
Because he was in About a Boy. He was the kid in About a Boy. Yeah. Well, you're dead right. I have never seen an episode of Skins, so I don't have that history. So as far as all these people turn up in Game of Thrones, and they're completely new to me.
And the guy who was in Startup and Unbreakable, whose name I can't remember, who's also great, he was from Skins. He's made it out. He's great.
Startup and Unbreakable. Yeah. I can't even remember what those films are. That's
how Unbreakable much the Angelina Jolie?
Yes.
Oh, the O something.
O'Connell.
O'Connell. Jack O'Connell.
Jack O'Connell.
Thank God we got some facts just before the show ends. We finally managed to... that would have been a terrible end to the show. The O guy.
That actor who I love. Oh,
yeah. That, ladies and gentlemen, is our show for this week. If you've enjoyed this episode, you can subscribe to us at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious, where you'll find ways to communicate with us via the old-fashioned email, or you can make a comment on the website.
Yes, you can also follow us on Twitter at Rancho Podcast. That's RANCHO Podcast, all one word, where we will be tweeting incessantly about things we think are interesting. And you can interact with us on Letterboxd as well, thanks to Reezy Pie. Our username is Rancho Notorious, all one word.
For incessantly, cross that out and read occasionally. The show is a Funerals and Snakes production. Season 2, which is rapidly coming to an end, is executive produced by Robert Cato, Random Films, Claire Quiray, Mark Cuby, Anthony S. Pratt, Fred Thompson, and Matthew Buchanan. The theme music is Ennio Morricone's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly by Loz Plantronics. You can buy that at the iTunes store. We're going to play you out with some more music. The soundtrack for Avengers Age of Ultron by Brian Tyler doesn't actually get released for a couple of days, but in the time period in which we're... This is so confusing. In a couple of days' time, it'll be released, and then I'll be able to buy it, and then I'll be able to play it underneath the what you're listening to right now. So you're actually listening to it right now, but I haven't bought it yet, and it doesn't really exist. But anyway, special thanks to our guest, Andy James.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Your Rarotonga correspondent. How long are you in Rarotonga for?
Till the end of this year.
Till the end of this year?
That'll make it 2 years.
Do you have telephones there?
We have telephones. We have broadband internet.
Do you have Skype?
It's just very expensive.
Do you have Skype?
We have Skype, but we can't use it because it's too expensive.
Okay, we must find a way to get you back on the show to be our Rarotonga correspondent.
Have me back for Ant-Man. More comic book goodness.
When's that?
Sometime this year.
Sometime.
Another couple of months.
I don't know how I feel about Ant-Man. I don't know how I feel.
I don't know.
Neither.
Yeah, no, good call.
Well, and actually, looking forward to it.
As a reviewer, probably a good idea to not know how to feel about it.
I'm Team Edgar, okay? All the way.
Absolutely. All right. Extra special bravos to my partner Karen, who's outside tapping furiously on the hoping that we will come out and we won't have, I don't know, overcooked pork for dinner. She makes sure that everyone who visits us here at Rancho Notorious is well fed, very well watered, and very well looked after. Big ups also to sous chefs Ian Freer and Sebastian McCauley for their assistance. Once again, thanks to you, Kaylee. Thanks to everybody for listening. We're off for dinner now, so that's good evening from me, Dan Slevin.
Good evening from me.